Hello, this is John Richardson speaking with you from Canada. Today is Monday, November the 8th, 2021, and I am pleased to continue my ongoing series of podcasts based on Charles Adams' great book, For Good and Evil, The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization. And once again, I am joined with my partner in this exercise, Jimmy Sexton, who is the CEO and founder of the Exquire Group, who is in Dubai. It's the beginning of the day for me and the end of the day for him, I think. So welcome, Jimmy. How are you today?
I am fantastic, but I'm actually joining you this week from Vienna, Austria. Next week, I will be back to Dubai. I'm fantastic. I'm really enjoying this podcast series. I know that our friends and followers on LinkedIn are also quite enjoying it. So I hope they continue to follow us and find interest in these, well, at least what I find fascinating topics we're discussing.
Oh, it is fascinating stuff. But I mean, let's remind everybody, I think everybody should follow this discussion, but the best way to follow the discussion would be to get the Charles Adams book. For Good and Evil, The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization. And this is a fantastic piece of work on the history of taxation and how it drives so, so much more than taxation. So he's not getting any royalties off it. He just was deceased in, I think, 2011 or around that time. But his book is a testament to a fantastic life of research, teaching, and imagine. A career as basically a tax historian. Yeah. And at the end of the book, you know, there's a chapter called Learning from the Past, and he has 27 lessons that one can learn from looking at the history of taxation. And, you know, what it reminds me of is, you know, in the world of investment, people sometimes say, this time it's different. Well, you know, when it comes to tax, it's never really different. I think that these are eternal lessons. And today is
three. They are eternal lessons that we seem to not be learning.
That is right. You know, and the interesting question is, why are these things not being learned? And I think that part of the answer to that, and we ought to do a separate discussion of this, might be, I mean, looking at what's been going on in the United States, is that I'm not sure that Congress should be allowed to have anything to do with the tax laws. Mess this up.
Yeah, well, I would absolutely agree with you. And I think it has two things to do. I think there's two things to do with it. One, Congress is making it way too complicated. And the propaganda surrounding all the tax laws, and it's only going to affect these small amount of people, and everybody else is going to benefit, is also very misleading. And the people in America, the education system has gotten so bad that most of them couldn't understand it anyway, unfortunately.
Well, when it comes to the U.S. tax system, it's so complicated, I'm not sure anybody can understand it. I mean, you know, you're a tax professional. I think that you would agree with the following statement that I'll throw out for you. Which is that I think that there are tax professionals only with respect to certain areas of taxation. You know, there are very, very few generalists. And, you know, when we look at the stuff that's driving the agenda today, you know, this these CFC rules and, you know, this stuff is so complicated that I don't believe that very many people can understand it without investing a huge amount of their life.
I mean, listen, I'm just finishing up an article for Bloomberg's Estates, Gifts, and Trusts Journal, talking about foreign trusts. And I got stuck on one issue that, you know, our friend Virginia and I were sparring back and forth on what's right. We think we finally figured it out after days of just researching this one issue. And we're still not 1,000% confident. And it doesn't seem that any of the research we can find that anybody else is 100% confident either.
Well, that's right. And I think that's one reason why people write these articles, you know, in trade journals or anywhere else, is to get feedback, on their thinking. But, you know, it's absolutely obscene to have a tax system that is so complex that, you know, people can't understand what's even expected of them. And that's where we are today.
And that's what I was talking about, the education system in America. I mean, none of this stuff is taught to people, right? I mean, you're expected, it's not most people's fault, but you know, in the US, you're basically expected to be born knowing the tax code, but it doesn't show up in any curriculum that, that you're taught this, and people are just left ignorant of it, and then they run afoul of it because they were supposed to know something they were never taught.
Or had any reason to think that even existed. Well, on that note,
that's absolutely correct.
Yeah, it's interesting, that the educational system, I mean, obviously they talk about basic government, they talk about the U.S. Constitution, giving the impression that the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land. But, leading into lesson three today, I don't think the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the United States. Frankly, I think it's the Internal Revenue Code. What do you think?
I would agree with you. I mean, how many tens of thousands of pages or hundreds of thousands of pages is the tax code? And I mean, it runs everything, right? I mean, every single decision, and not only in the United States, but in most advanced tax systems, decisions are almost exclusively driven by tax. I mean, anything you want to do, you want to buy a house, you want to buy a car, you want to go to the grocery store, what county it's in. I mean, everything is dictated by tax, and tax needs to be considered. I mean, this is what they need to be teaching in school.
Well, I think that's right. And, as I probably said on this very podcast before, I think it's reached the point in America where every family needs its own personal tax lawyer, which is why I guess so many people go to law school. Send your kid to law school, get them to study tax. It's the best investment you can make.
Yeah, exactly. Until they drive themselves mad with you and wind up in the insane asylum because Internal Revenue Code's so complicated.
Well, it is very complicated. And, since we're so far into this, I'd be interested in your, I'll give you some of my views of why it's complicated. But
I think at some point we should read this third lesson here. I think
absolutely. Absolutely. I'll read this, or do you want to read it in?
You go ahead and read it.
All right. Here is lesson three to give context to our discussion. All-encompassing taxation vests enormous power in the tax bureau, which in time tends to overpower not only the taxpayer, but also the other branches of government. Even kings and emperors have had to yield to the power of their tax bureau. Well, I think he's right on.
So do I. And I think that this very much goes to your point that the Internal Revenue Code has become the Constitution of the United States.
Yeah, a very recent example of that, when I say has become the Constitution, I guess what I mean is that everything else is really subject to it. But, recently the 10th Circuit handed down this decision in this MAGR case, whatever it was. What it ostensibly was about a passport revocation issue. It's now reached the point in America where if you have a tax debt of $50,000 or more, you can have your passport revoked. And, for somebody who's never been outside the United States, I'm not sure that has a great deal of practical meaning. But, there are Americans who live outside the United States and have to have a U.S. passport to maintain the visa in the country they're in, for example. Or there are people who, want to leave the United States, whatever. But part of the discussion in the case was, raising the question, well, hang on a minute. Isn't there a constitutional or, a very important entrenched right to international travel, that a tax law ought not to be able to, overrun. And what was interesting about the case was that the court actually held that the right to travel was not an issue of significant importance, that it was somehow exempt from the application of these tax laws.
Well, if I remember correctly, and you tell me if I'm wrong, but I if I remember this particular case correctly, what the court did was sort of sidestepped the issue a little bit, and the court addressed the constitutionality of this passport, of the certification of the tax debt. At least the case I read, what the court said was, well, listen, the Internal Revenue Service is not revoking the passport. They're simply certifying the severely delinquent tax debt and then notifying the Department of State. And what they said, if I remember correctly, was that the certification itself does not impact the person's ability to travel. They're just certifying that the person owes money. And that then it's the State Department that takes the action. So it would seem to me that there may still be a lawsuit to be had against the State Department, if we're talking about the same case.
I think we probably are talking about the same case. I have to read it again. But, you know, it doesn't make a lot of difference, in my view, anyway, in terms of basic principle, because the whole point here is that, you know, I mean, for the Treasury Department takes a position, well, it's not them. They're just certifying delinquent tax. And it's sort of like saying, you know, well, of course, I mean, you know, so you have two people, persons A and B, getting ready to shoot somebody, and person A puts the bullet in the gun for person B, and B shoots. I mean, are you seriously saying that A didn't cause the death?
Okay. Point taken.
Yeah, no, I mean, but I mean, that, you know, that would be a technical argument, right? And yeah, I agree. Reading these kinds of technical arguments, you know, in law school, you know, of course, where you read these arguments. But, you know, I think the basic principle here is that everything must lead to taxation. I mean, even the Anti-Injunction Act, right? You know, which in its basic form says that you can't, you know, that you can only challenge an assessment after you paid it. I think that's basically what it says, right?
I believe so.
Yeah. And in other words, okay, you can sue anybody you want unless it's the Department of Treasury over a tax debt, basically. I mean, that's, you know, that's what it means. And, you know, and that's another example of that. And I think a very, very topical example would also be this, that if we look at, you know, the whole FATCA IGAs and the FATCA law, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, which, you know, is a very, very, very clear, deliberate, intentional, with knowledge, okay, attempt to override basic privacy rights, you know, whether they are rights guaranteed by local legislation or, you know, possible constitutional rights in the United States, whatever. I mean, once it's about taxation and the acquisition of data, there are no rights that can really compete with that, seems to me.
Well, I would agree with you. I mean, in addition to that, I would also add that, you know, you also have the Administrative Procedures Act that stands in your way to really fighting with the IRS. You know, a lot of times you have to go through exhaust all administrative remedies within the IRS before you can even file to get to court. And in my experience, you know, I mean, the IRS's administrative procedures process, I mean, they're very one-sided. They're all for the IRS, right? And I mean, in order, most people can't afford to go through all of the administrative procedures that the IRS has and then go to court as well. And then on top of that, when you talk about, you know, all other rights going away, I mean, let's talk about the IRS's ability to issue summonses to banks and businesses and whoever else to get information when they're auditing somebody. And all of this without any sort of court order or judge's sign off, right? I mean, they can just issue them, or their ability to lien your property before you can even appeal. Or their ability to levy your bank account, or levy any other type of property, you know, funds held in the hands of third parties, for example. So I think that there's really a lot that the IRS is capable of doing on their own without any kind of oversight, really.
Well, you know, you put it that way, and I was immediately thinking, well, you know, the IRS is sort of judge, jury, and executioner. But the way you describe it, I think we might add that the IRS is also the legislator, judge, jury, and executioner.
Well, I would agree with that because they have a lot, they have wide latitude in drafting the regulations. And, you know, the regulations are often vastly different than the code that was passed by Congress.
Well, I certainly would agree with you on that. I mean, it's always fascinating. And this is, you know, I think this gives a great insight into the way tax laws are made, is that I have the impression that, let's look, for example, at the basic reporting requirements, information return requirements. And what's interesting about them is that, you know, basically they give Treasury the authority to make up the rules for, you know, what should be the reporting for the foreign corporations, for example, right? Yeah. Or, you know, if you look at the foreign trust rules, which are such a problem for people, there's a section in there that gives Treasury the authority to actually unilaterally exempt, you know, what might be trust, right, from, you know, the whole reporting regime, et cetera. Yeah. So there's a very, very clear delegation of law of, you know, if it's not, well, it is lawmaking because the regulations have the force of law, I think, right? You know, very clear delegation of lawmaking to the IRS, which raises the question. I mean, do you think that it is reasonable or appropriate for the agency administering the law to be able to make up the law they're administering?
No. And even if they are, they should, no, absolutely not. And then they certainly shouldn't have, you know, to appeal their rulings should certainly go to a third party judiciary rather than their internal administrative law judges.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's a tremendous problem. And, you know, I mean, how do people get around this? I mean, I think the trick is, you know, my definition of wealth in the 21st century with all this is going on is the ability to be happy and live on very small amounts of money in a simple way and love it. I think that's probably the best you can do, right?
Yeah. I mean, listen, I think everybody has their own definition of wealth. For me, being wealthy means to be free. To be free of the IRS. But no, to really be free of any sort of overbearing government, whether that be that of the United States or any other one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to be clear, although we're using U.S.-driven examples, this is in no way restricted to the United States. I mean, there's no doubt about that. You know, as you know, I live in Canada, and they have a fairly brutal system of, you know, taxation. And, you know, the general apparatus is definitely stacked against the taxpayer here as well. But, you know, part of the problem with the U.S. system is the complexity of it, right? The almost complete lack of ability to understand on your own what it is that's actually required of you. And then that's a reason why people renounce U.S. citizenship, in my experience. It's not that they don't want to comply with the laws, it's that they can't even know what they're supposed to comply with.
Well, I mean, look, I think most of the people that I've helped expatriate over the years, very few of them have done it to let's say, save on taxes, right? Some of it has been, most of it has been driven with the compliance cost and risks. I mean, most of the people, I mean, so many people that expatriate, they're not paying taxes anyway in the United States. I mean, when you look at people that are living in Europe, they pay so many more taxes in Europe that with the foreign tax credits, they wind up not paying in the United States. But they're so scared of the compliance risk and then the compliance cost that they don't have a choice.
Yeah, well, and all, just the sheer amount of time it takes. I think, you know, one of the problems with U.S. citizenship that is so tied into taxation, I mean, I would call it taxation-based citizenship, right, is the amount of time it takes and, you know, how much attempts to comply, you know, impact your ability to think clearly about other aspects of your life.
And you know what? And what's unfortunate is, you know, when I talk to my clients that have expatriated themselves, you know, some of them have even told me when they've gone in to expatriate, met with the consular officer, and the consular officer asked them why they were expatriating, they told them, whatever you do, don't say tax. You know, and I mean, this is coming from the consular officers. So, you know, it's well known within the U.S. government that this is a real problem. And I mean, even the consular officers are, you know, trying to help out the citizens who are giving up their citizenship, you know, to not be classified as having done it for tax reasons.
Well, they don't do it for tax reasons. I mean, that's also my experience. They do it because they want to be in compliance with the law generally. I mean, these are law-abiding people who are NAFs, and they just find it too difficult. And they find the stress and worry of the possibility of non-compliance more than they can bear.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's really sad. I mean, when we talk about this third lesson and you know, the all-encompassing nature of a tax system, I mean, it's sad that we as humans have to dedicate so much of our life to thinking about tax, and especially Americans abroad.
Yeah, well, you know, in Toronto, corner of Bay and King is sort of the financial corner center of Canada. And one night I was walking, very late at night, walking there, and I stopped and I looked up, and there's these four skyscrapers, one in each corner. And every one of them was branded with an accounting firm or a law firm, you know, KPMG, I think, was one of them. And, you know, I paused for a minute and I thought, I mean, do you realize that all these people do is fill out forms?
Yeah. Well, let's also not forget how much lobbying the Big Four does to keep it complicated and to do more regulation so that they're the only ones that can figure it out and guarantee themselves job security.
Well, they can guarantee themselves job security. Whether they can guarantee they can figure this stuff out, I'm not so sure, because the way the U.S. tax laws seem to work to me is that there's never any, they've never, at least since, you know, maybe the 50s, I don't know. I mean, when was the last time there was actually a complete rethinking of the Internal Revenue Code? And I would not count 1986. You know, that was just, you know, pasting more stuff over it. And what happens is, you know, they, for example, they add guilty to subpart, you know, the subpart F provisions. Yeah. I discussion a few days ago about, is this really subpart F or is it something else? And then somebody else chimes in and says, well, maybe they should get rid of subpart F. The problem is they never get rid of anything. But I mean, yeah. I think there's some truth to that, right? That it's like a terrible, terrible website that has just been sort of patched over the years. And now
it's my website.
Well, or some of the ones I've had over the years. Listen, you're fairly modern by my standards, but you know, and part of the problem is you can't read the stuff now without knowing the history of it. And it is, I think it's reached the point of almost impossibility to comprehend it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you and I would agree that the whole tax system vests far too much power in one administrative agency, right?
Absolutely. And they keep vesting more power in.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you look at this whole, the Democrats, as you know, everybody knows, have been trying to, you know, make some tax changes. But interestingly, part of what they're doing is they want to dramatically increase IRS funding.
Yep. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much you actually deal with the IRS. It's been many, many years since I've dealt with the IRS, but I know a lot of people that do. And, you know, one of the big problems with dealing with the IRS is the people that they're hiring are not the best and the brightest. A lot of them, you know, to work for the IRS, you don't even have to have a college education. I mean, these people are essentially taking training courses and then being sent out to attack these ungodly complex problems really not being properly equipped to do so.
Well, that's certainly true in the area of anything that's foreign, or, you know, what they would call international tax. There's no doubt about it. Well, you know, you go online, you know, occasionally you search a topic and you'll, you know, some of these IRS training manuals come up, right?
Yeah.
In different areas. And they're very interesting to read because they, you know, they give you, and sort of a very base level, you know, the IRS view of what a certain section means, or, you know, or how it should be interpreted. And I mean, it's unquestionably very accurate, but it's also unquestionably a lack of nuance as well, right?
Yep.
So I think that people would be well advised to make sure that, you know, whatever they're doing is checking off the boxes that are laid out in those IRS training manuals.
No, I would agree. I mean, I obviously don't have any proof of this, but, you know, my experience with the IRS over the years has been that, you know, if you're unfortunate enough to get audited, it doesn't matter how legal what you did was, or how well thought out it was, or how well intentioned, you're always going to lose. And the only chance that you really have at winning is if you're willing to go the distance and fight them in court. Because internally, I think they're just trained to screw the taxpayer. I mean, I think they really have a corrupt culture over there that needs to be rebuilt from the ground up, unfortunately.
Well, do you think it's corrupt, or do you think it's just sort of unenlightened?
Well, I think it's corrupt. I think that they believe that they are a class above everybody else, and that it is a competition of what they can do to the taxpayer. When you see some of the unreasonable things that I've seen happen over the years, I mean, I remember a tax court case one time that a buddy of mine was trying, and one of the issues that they wound up having to go to court on was the client taking deductions on his tax return for expenses that he paid with a credit card. And the IRS was trying to take the position that he was not entitled to those deductions unless he could prove he paid a credit card bill, which is just nonsense, right? As soon as the debt was incurred and the expense was paid, and I mean, lots of nonsense like that. I remember the same attorney was trying another case where the auditor on the IRS case used to work for a competitor of the taxpayer. the audit was so ludicrous that the stuff that this auditor disallowed, that when the taxpayer eventually got so far that he had to pay the tax and eventually sued for a refund, and then you're dealing with the Department of Justice instead of, you know, IRS counsel, that the IRS hid the file from the Department of Justice and never turned it over, ever. And the Department of Justice had to redo basically the whole audit. The client wound up getting his money back plus a bunch of interest. But, you know, I mean, what else can you call that but corruption, hiding the file?
Oh, there's no question that is, no question. You know, but this is, I think, an issue. You know, what occurs to me is that this is sort of an issue of policing in general, right? You know, what you're describing is really, you know, the IRS seeing itself as a law enforcement agency, right?
For sure.
You know, which may be different from a tax administration agency. But I mean, this is the problem with law enforcement right around the world, is that, you know, the entry level standards to get into it are not particularly high. And there are a lot of people out trying to administer these laws or enforce these laws, you know, who don't fully understand the laws. And certainly with the tax laws, the enforcement of the law based on the letter of the law is always at the expense of context, and I think often good judgment as well. Because, you know, everybody's in violation of something 24/7, right?
Well, I think wasn't there a book or a paper or something published by somebody not that long ago that said that the average American commits 3 felonies a day?
Is it that low?
Well, yeah, I mean, this might be kind of old. I mean, we might be up to 7 or 8 now.
I don't think it's possible in the United States because, you know, you have 50 state laws, you have federal laws, you have I don't think it's possible for anybody to exist without being in violation of something all the time.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you.
Well, so what would you suggest here? I mean, I have a suggestion as we bring this to an end, maybe we can pick this up. But I think part of the problem here is that I don't think that Congress fully understands the laws they're making, period. And in the same way, it's unreasonable to expect the IRS to be able to enforce this incomprehensible stuff. I also think that it's not desirable to have a bunch of, you know, elected representatives who probably bought their seats generally, you know, to be involved in trying to make these tax laws that are so important. I mean, do you think that there ought to be a bipartisan commission that is the only entity that can make tax laws in the United States? I mean, look at how toxically partisan it's become.
I think that is a very interesting concept, one that I've never given any thought to. But I would agree that a solution other than the one that we have now is needed, because what's happening now is, I mean, they're just like this billionaire tax and all this stuff. I mean, they're just making things up that they think sound good and they might be able to get passed. And then they're just voting on it without really, I think, studying the impact of it. And yeah, I think that's a really good idea.
Yeah, well, maybe we ought to make that a separate a discussion someday. You know, I'm gonna say
they should elect us as the founding members of that committee, John.
Well, I think they probably should. I mean, it would certainly be better than what they have now. I mean, at least it wouldn't be, you know, class warfare. I really think, as it stands right now, the United States has separate tax systems for undocumented aliens, Americans abroad, employees, the self-employed, the very, very wealthy, you know, et cetera. I mean, they've got like 4 or 5, maybe 6 separate tax systems. And I don't think that that's a good idea. I mean, I think that there ought to be one tax system for the country. Would you agree?
Well, I mean, listen, that would seem like the fair and equal thing to do.
But they're not interested in fairness. They're not interested in equality. They're interested in revenue and punishment, punishing people they don't like.
It seems like they're even more interested in punishment than revenue, because a lot of the laws that they make don't make a lot of sense. I think FATCA's still an overall money loser for them.
Oh, there's no question. It's a money loser. But, you know, look at the H-77A, the expatriation rules. It's quite interesting because other countries have departure taxes, but they base them on, you know, primarily capital gains, right? Yeah. Because once people leave, you know, they lose the right to tax those. But the U.S. has gone one step further, you know, taxing all kinds of U.S. source stuff like 401ks and all these kinds of things that they still retain tax jurisdiction over. You know, they don't have to, you know, add those things to these deemed sale rules. And they do that be just as punishment, right?
Well, I mean, they do that as punishment, but the most egregious punishment contained in the expatriation rules is the gift and estate tax rules that apply to gifts or inheritances from covered expatriates.
That is incredible stuff. I think it's worth an explanation on that. You want to give the readers a version of how that law works?
Yeah, so, you know, if you're a covered expatriate, basically, and you give a gift or bequest inheritance to any U.S. person, directly or indirectly, right? So that means whether you just give it to them directly or you give it to them through some type of a trust or something like that. The recipient is liable for gift or estate tax on that property at the highest gift or estate tax rate then in effect.
Yeah, I mean, that's really it's amazing stuff. And just to add to it a little bit, what is not immediately obvious when you read it, and I've had a lot of these types of situations with people, right? Is that, you know, let's say they're a covered expatriate, and let's say that they, you know, have $3 million. What's important to understand is that the amount that's subject to the gift tax is not restricted to the $3 million. Let's say they're worth $100 million when they die, $100 million. So, I mean, this has nothing to do with anything the U.S. has a tax interest whatsoever. It's just pure, outrageous punishment.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, it also is the reason for the family expatriation. You know, it's a family bonding event. What did you do this summer? Well, we traveled. Well, we all renounced U.S. citizenship.
Well, you know, what I was gonna add to this was that, you know, what's even more egregious is that it is the U.S. person recipient that has to prove that the gift wasn't from a covered expatriate.
That's right. Incredible stuff.
I mean, this is one of the reasons that with a lot of covered expatriate clients that I've advised over the years, we've set up trusts and stuff for them and they say that U.S. persons can't receive under the trust, right? So basically, if their kids want money out of the trust at some point, they're going to have to expatriate. Because
that's right. Well, I think that's very reasonable. It's very reasonable. Well, on that completely accurate, realistic, but also very depressing note, we probably should call it for today, but let me just read in one more time the third lesson that this has all been in furtherance of. And it's Charles Adams writing, "All encompassing taxation vests enormous power in the tax bureau, which in time tends to overpower not only the taxpayer, but also the other branches of government. Even kings and emperors have had to yield to the power of their tax bureau." You know, he's such a minimalist, isn't he?
Yeah, great writer, very insightful.
Absolutely. All right, well, this has been great, and we will be picking this up 1 week from today with lesson 4. And again, as a reminder, I urge everybody to get the book For Good and Evil, The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization by Charles Adams, and continue with us on this journey. So thanks very much, Jimmy, and we'll pick it up next week.
Thank you so much, John.